Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Courier for Thursday, July 21st, 2022. And I am your reader, and this is the IRIS Radio, Iowa Radio Reading Service Information Service for the Blind. Iowans break betting record, average of $11 million a day, was bet last fiscal year. Iowa gamblers placed a record amount of bets online and persons on both casino and sports games in the last fiscal year, with wagers topping $4 billion, an average of nearly $11 million a day. Iowa's 19 state licensed casinos reported adjusted gross revenue of nearly $1.78 billion from slot machines and table games, and a separate sports wagering handle of more than $2.4 billion that netted them nearly $140 million in receipts for the 12-month period ending June 30th, Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission data shows. That was the highest year on record in terms of adjusted gross revenue, said Brian Arcorio, the commissioner's administrator. Casinos posted strong numbers during the first part of the fiscal year, from July through December and into January, as the Iowa and U.S. economies rebounded and the state relaxed and eventually ended COVID-19 public health mitigation measures. Iowa casinos saw increased attendance, which had not been the case for the last several years. Casinos saw more than 17.4 million admissions in fiscal 22, up 6.5% from the previous fiscal year, but still down from 22.8 million through the turnstiles during the record year of fiscal 2012. Wes Ehrlicke, president and chief executive officer of the Iowa Gaming Association and umbrella group for the licensed casinos in Iowa, attributed the increase in revenues and admissions to pent-up demand during the pandemic and the public viewing Iowa's casinos as premier entertainment destinations where they felt comfortable and safe during the ongoing pandemic. The increased betting action proved profitable for the state, with casinos paying over $349 million in state taxes on gambling at their facilities and $9.6 million in state taxes on sports betting proceeds. In addition to casinos, state proceeds from lottery profits stood at $89.7 million on nearly $400 million in sales through May. The Iowa Lottery Authority expected to issue its 12-month financial data next month, a revised total that will push overall gambling in Iowa for fiscal 2022 well above $4.2 billion. Casino betting, however, has cooled in the last 3 months as the cost of fuel and goods and services have soared, with inflation hitting a 40-year high and putting a strain on household budgets. Admissions to Iowa casinos and adjusted gross receipts fell the last 3 months compared with the same period last year. Casino admissions in the fourth quarter of fiscal 2022, April through June this year, were 13% below the average admissions for all fourth quarters since 2010. It's not possible to determine whether admissions in the future will rebound or whether a new normal can be expected, according to the latest report from the state's Fiscal Services Division. Ehrlicke said that the revenues will be tough to replicate, but show a robust gaming industry in Iowa that people enjoy coming to. Iowa casinos and their sportsbook partners collected $122.4 million in sports bets for the month of June, a 10% increase from June a year ago. And casinos and sports books should see an uptick in August, followed by an even larger increase in September with the return of NFL and college football, Mitchell went on to say. Societal costs. Tom Coates, executive director of a Des Moines Credit Counseling Service and a leading gambling critic in Iowa, worries about the societal cost of the state's $4 billion plus appetite for gambling. The Iowa Problem Gambling Services Program with the State Department of Public Health reported more contacts last year from people seeking gambling problem referrals, with casino table games and slot machines primarily cited, followed by lottery and sports wagering. Updated numbers on contacts to Your Life Iowa for gambling-related issues were not immediately available on Wednesday. Coates worries that the state will see a growing percentage of Iowans, particularly young Iowans, developing gambling addictions due to the ease, prevalence, and popularity of sports betting, where individuals can gamble from home using a credit card. He said casino operators realize they need to move towards sports and online games that attract younger clients, and which can be highly addictive because that's where their bread and butter is. Iowa requires casinos and sports betting companies to create tools that allow individuals to place their own restrictions on how much they gamble. Such limits are voluntary for gamblers. Responsible gambling is very important for the commission, and I believe for the operators as well. Orilko went on to say. And in other news, senators mum on marriage equality. Iowa's U.S. senators did not say whether they'd vote for a bill protecting the federal right to same-sex and interracial marriage after the measure passed the U.S. House with support from three of Iowa's four U.S. House members. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, told reporters on Wednesday he didn't think that the U.S. Supreme Court's past decisions on marriage equality were at risk of being overturned, but he didn't say whether he'd vote or against the bill if it goes to a vote in the Senate. I'm also not aware of any pending challenges to any of the other decisions that this bill agrees with, Grassley said. But I do want you to know that I'm going to read the text and the House bill, and we'll wait and see if that is going to come up in the United States Senate. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa, said that she's keeping an open mind on the bill on Wednesday, according to HuffPost reporter Igor Bobik. U.S. Reps Ashley Hinson and Marinette Miller Meeks, both Republicans, and Cindy Axne, a Democrat, voted for the bill on Tuesday. Republican Randy Feenstra, Republican of Iowa, voted against it. The bill passed 267-157 with support from every Democrat and 47 Republicans. The bill would repeal the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, which defined marriage as between one man and one woman, and would require states and federal governments to recognize marriage that were valid in the state, that they took place in regardless of sex or race. The Defense of Marriage Act is still on the books, but it was invalidated in a 2015 Supreme Court decision that recognized a constitutional right to marriage equality. The bill will now go to the U.S. Senate, where it's unclear if it will get the 60 votes necessary to pass in the chamber. In a statement on Tuesday, Representative Ashley Hinson said that the legislation upheld settled law. Now, Democrats need to focus on policies that will help families, lowering costs for groceries and gas, securing our border to keep our communities safe, and getting our economy working again, she said. Today, I voted yes on the Respect for Marriage Act to enshrine marriage equality in federal law and ensure same-sex and interracial marriage will continue to be recognized, Axne said in a statement. I will continue fighting in Congress to protect these rights. Miller Meeks said that the bill protects legal precedent and First Amendment rights. This legislation aligns with the legal precedent, established by numerous U.S. Supreme Court rulings. Notably, rather, this bill does not require individuals or organizations to perform marriage contrary to their religious beliefs, upholding religious rights under the First Amendment to the Constitution, she said in a statement. The bill was the most recent measure by House Democrats to enshrine constitutional rights that had been previously recognized by the Supreme Court out of concerns that the court could roll back those rights in future decisions. The action was spurred on by the June Supreme Court decision in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which overturned the federal right to an abortion. In concurring opinion to Justice Samuel Alito's opinion in the Dobbs case, Justice Clarence Thomas said that the court should revisit its previous decisions made on substantive due process, including rights to contraception and same-sex marriage. The House has already passed bills protecting abortion rights and protections for people who travel for an abortion, but they likely won't get support to pass in the Senate. Democrats are also preparing for a vote this week on protecting access to contraception. On Tuesday, Miller, Meeks, and Hinson introduced competing legislation that would make birth control pills available over the counter, a measure Miller Meeks voted for as a state senator, but never cleared the Iowa House, to become law. This important bill will ensure that the FDA acts quickly to approve oral contraceptives for over-the-counter use, Miller Meeks went on to say in a statement. As a woman and a doctor, I recognize the need for increased access to contraceptives and believe that this bill is an important step to promote women's health. And now turning to other news, Healing Magic Hospice Grief Camp is chance to have day of fun for kids facing loss. In Waterloo, children were given the chance to laugh, cry, grieve, and celebrate the ones that they loved and lost on Wednesday as they took part in the Cedar Valley Hospice Grief Camp. At the UAW Hall, 32 children attended the day camp, which had a carnival theme. While there, children were treated to games and music, balloons and animals, a magic show, and other activities. According to Jennifer Seach, the hospice's marketing director, it also served as an important purpose of helping children to process their grief. Each of them had lost a family member or a loved one, and many of the activities involved were built around remembering them and celebrating their lives. We figured a day camp would be something that would mix in the fun with remembering and healing of their loved ones and giving them the chance to talk about the people they love, as well as letting them know their feelings are okay, Seach said, and giving them positive ways to deal with those feelings and work through them, as well as be with other kids who are in the same boat. Grief team leader Heather Pfeiffer said it often can be difficult for children to express or process their grief. In addition, the process can be isolating for them, and they don't want to open up, even among their peers who are dealing with similar issues. Events like this allow them to share those difficult experiences, and know that they're not alone, she said. Kylie Moore is one child who's been positively impacted. Moore, 10 years old, lost her grandmother to cancer in 2020. But through events like these day camps and the help of counselors like Michaela Hines, she learned to process her loss and be comforted by her grandmother's memory. I like to wake up in the morning and think of her, and I want to be there for her, Moore said. I want to keep going to live the life she didn't get to live forever, and I want to live the rest of my life for her. Moore shared her grandmother's story with her peers while hearing their stories as well. And now let's go over to the Cedar Falls area. Cedar Falls panel downtown review debated all building gets P&Z input, council proposes. In Cedar Falls, debate continued among elected officials this week as to whether Planning and Zoning Commission's review of new downtown buildings is necessary. In response to a city council petition, the commission unanimously recommended it review site plans for all new buildings proposed in the Urban General 2, and storefront areas in the downtown character district. The council on Monday countered the recommendation from the commission by voting 4-3 in favor of Councillor Daryl Cruz's motion that any floor expansion or residential addition plan for existing buildings there will also be reviewed as part of a future amendment to the new downtown code. Councillors Simon Harding, Kelly Dunn, and Gil Schultz voted against the motion. One example for which Cruz felt the commission review would be necessary was a non-residential building being expanded to include residential units, which he said would trigger different parking requirement scenarios. I think that's prudent to see what's going on, Cruz said. This latest petition will return to the Planning and Zoning Commission for consideration and another recommendation on how to proceed forward. Monday's discussion marked a continuation of the year-long debate surrounding the new downtown zoning code and amendments to it. The commission had considered a recommendation when initially looking at the council's petition similar to what Cruz put forth. Require all site plans, including all new buildings, all changes to existing buildings, projecting signs, site changes to be reviewed by the commission and approved by city council. Are we going to kick stuff back just because we don't get the answer that we are seeking? I feel like that's what's happening, said Dunn. We're not getting what we want, so we consistently and constantly kick it back. The Planning and Zoning Commission has already had Cruz's proposal in front of them. The new zoning regulations are described as being more black and white and leaving little to no wiggle room to be debated. That's one main reason why that there was deemed to no need for site plans to be reviewed by the commission at a meeting in which the public is allowed to weigh in. Even if a project is denied by the commission and city council, it can proceed if a court of law says it legally abides by the new zoning rules set by the governing body. The Planning and Zoning Commission very specifically said that they didn't need to see the site plans for expansions of buildings. These were just for very new projects or brand new buildings, said Planning and Community Services Manager Karen Howard. I think they felt like the rules in the zoning ordinance in the charter, or the character rather, district, were specific enough to guide that project for expansions or remodels of existing buildings. The council adopted the new code in November in order to bring to life a vision for the downtown that has been crafted after multiple public input sessions. Instead of a Planning Zoning Commission review for new buildings and significant remodels, the new code dictates that a staff zoning review committee looks at the site plans to determine whether or not a plan complies with the approved regulations. The Urban General 2 and storefront designations primarily cover the downtown areas involving State, Main, Washington, and Clay Streets, as well as 1st to 7th Streets. Other areas like the highway and mixed uses districts outside of the downtown require site plans to come before the commission. There's always intangibles, said Cruz. You cannot black and white and write down every scenario. That's why the law books continue to expand and expand and expand. And you have court cases and court cases. There's a lot of gray areas, a lot of things that may be detrimental to downtown that we have to look at. What would cause us not to approve a project? And now let's take a look at today in history. Today is Thursday, July 21st, the 202nd day of 2022, and there are 163 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On July 21st, 1925, the so-called monkey trial ended in Dayton, Tennessee, with John T. Scopes found guilty of violating state law for teaching Darwin's theory of evolution. The conviction was later overturned on a technicality. On this date, in 1861, during the Civil War, the first Battle of Bull Run was fought at Manassas, Virginia, resulting in a Confederate victory. In 1944, American forces landed on Guam during World War II, capturing it from the Japanese some 3 weeks later. In 1954, the Geneva Conference concluded with accords dividing Vietnam into North and South entities. In 1969, Apollo 11 astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin blasted off from the moon aboard the ascent stage of the lunar module for docking with the command module. In 1972, the Irish Republican Army carried out 22 bombings in Belfast, Northern Ireland, killing 9 people and injuring 130 in what became known as Bloody Friday. In 1998, astronaut Alan Shepard died in Monterey, California at the age of 74. Actor Robert Young died at Westlake Village, California at the age of 91. In 1999, Navy divers found and recovered the bodies of John F. Kennedy Jr., his wife, Carolyn, and sister-in-law, Lauren Bessett, in the wreckage of Kennedy's plane in the Atlantic Ocean off Martha's Vineyard. In 2002, Ernie Els won the British Open in the first sudden-death finish in the 142-year history of the tournament. In 2008, former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadžić, one of the world's top war crimes fugitives, was arrested in a Belgrade suburb by Serbian security forces. He was sentenced by a UN court in 2019 to life in prison after being convicted of genocide crimes against humanity and war crimes. In 2009, prosecutors in Cambridge, Massachusetts, dropped a disorderly conduct charge against prominent black scholar Henry Louis Gates Jr., who was arrested by a white officer at his home near Harvard University after a report of a break-in. In 2011, the 30-year-old space shuttle program ended as Atlantis landed at Cape Canaveral, Florida, after the 135th shuttle flight. In 2016, Donald Trump accepted the GOP presidential nomination with a speech in which he pledged to cheering Republicans and still skeptical voters that as president, he would restore the safety they feared they were losing, strictly curb immigration and save the nation from what he said was Hillary Clinton's record of death and destruction, terrorism and weakness. The NBA moved the 2017 All-Star Game out of Charlotte because of its objections to a North Carolina law that limited anti-discrimination protections for lesbian, gay, and transgender people. 10 years ago, the president of the International Olympic Committee, Jacques Rogge, rejected the latest calls for a minute of silence for the Israeli victims of the 1972 Munich massacre at the opening ceremony of the London Olympics. Staff Sergeant Louise Walker, an Air Force training instructor at Lakeland Air Force Base in San Antonio, was sentenced to 20 years in prison for crimes that included rape and sexual assault. Walker died in August of 2014. 5 years ago, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer abruptly quit over President Donald Trump's decision to name financier Anthony Scaramucci as the new White House Communications Director. Scaramucci announced from the White House briefing room that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who had been Spicer's deputy, would take over for Spicer. Scaramucci would be fired on July 31st after 11 days on the job. He had used vulgar language to insult White House aides during a phone call to a reporter. Escalating Israeli-Palestinian tensions over the Holy Land's most contested shrine boiled over into violence that killed 6 people, 3 Palestinians in street clashes in Jerusalem and 3 Israelis in a stabbing attack at a West Bank settlement. And in other news in the Waterloo area, schools outsource trash collection. Annual savings eyed of $38,000 to $46,000. In Waterloo, Waterloo Community Schools is changing its trash pickup after the Board of Education last week agreed to outsource waste collection. A 3-year contract was approved by the board with an annual savings of about between $38,000 and $46,000 depending on the year. The district has used in-house pickup in the past, but Interim Director of Operations Zach Kelly said at 20 years old, the garbage truck has little gas left in its tank. He noted that the average lifespan of the trucks is 15 to 20 years. It would take 10 to 12 months before the truck was delivered, which would have left Waterloo schools with unreliable service until arrival. The original proposal was to outsource trash collection for 1 year. However, Kelly came to the table with a 3-year proposal, noting it would be less expensive. In-house trash pickup was roughly $115,000 per year. The upside to in-house collection, Kelly said, is convenience and having service whenever the district needed it. The downside, he says, is that with such an old truck, Waterloo schools would be at the mercy of the services company working on it in the case of a breakdown. That could affect the time garbage is set out in the heat or was picked up at by birds making a mess. Kelly noted that garbage truck operators could hand-pick trash, but there's only so much they could pick up without physically touching the waste. He also said that work on the current garbage truck would be at an investment of around $30,000 for only 1 year. The first suggestion for a 1-year outsourcing contract was estimated at $87,000 from Republic Services. Republic also provided an option of a 3-year contract, which the board ultimately went with. Each year would have an increase of 5% a year. The first year will cost the school an estimated $69,000. The second year would be $73,000. And the third year would be $77,000. Republic also is providing all the dumpsters at no additional cost. As for the 52 current dumpsters, Kelly said that 25% of them will go to a metal salvage yard due to their condition. The other dumpsters will be housed at a location until the school goes back to in-house collection. School board members expressed concern about additional pickups, which would have normally been at no extra charge with in-house collection. Additional pickups are needed when the school has special events, like a football game or a musical, that attracts extra visitors. Kelly agreed that the additional pickups will come at a cost. For the first year, the district will pay $3 per yard. The majority of the dumpsters are 4 yards in length. The second year, the price will increase to $3.15 per yard. And the third year will increase to $3.31 per yard. Kelly said that the charge will not affect taxpayers. And that the school can terminate the contract without any cost if it is not up to their standards. Moving on to other Waterloo news. Larceny with ladder ends in arrest. A Waterloo man charged with break-in at female neighbor's apartment. A Waterloo man was arrested Wednesday after allegedly using a ladder to break into a woman's apartment to steal from her and for making her feel uncomfortable and frightened. Joseph Jack Roster, age 38, was charged with second-degree burglary and first-offense stalking and placed in the Black Hawk County Jail. According to the criminal affidavit, Waterloo police officers were dispatched on Monday at 6:44 p.m. to an apartment in the 600 block of West 2nd Street. The complainant told officers that Roster recently moved into the unit underneath her and was behaving strangely toward her. He allegedly brought her new locks for her apartment door that would have given him access to her living quarters because they would have used the same key as the common front door. The locks were not approved by the landlord. On Wednesday at 12:16 a.m., officers were summoned to the same address for a burglary and found the same victim crying and visibly in fear of the offender. Roster appeared to have entered the apartment when the woman was in her bedroom. The front door was opened after it had been locked, and from her bedroom she heard someone moving around in the living room. A ladder was found on the side of the apartment leading up to her living room window. Items were knocked over and blood was found. Some of her possessions were believed to have been stolen. Police verified items that had been taken from the woman after executing a search warrant on Roster's apartment. The offender admitted to having borrowed the ladder from a neighbor and using it to access the victim's window, said the criminal affidavit. The offender admitted to entering the victim's apartment through the window, taking an item and placing it in his apartment. The neighbor, who the ladder belonged to, told officers that the offender had taken and used his ladder in a similar manner recently to gain access to the victim's apartment. A preliminary hearing has been set for July 29th. Roster has not posted the $25,000 bond. You're listening to the reading of the Courier for January 21st, 2022, and I am your reader, Peter Welch, and you are listening to the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, also known as IRIS. And now let's turn to today's obituaries. James Scott Sorreda has passed at the age of 60. Memorials may be directed to Iowa DNR, the Northeast Iowa Food Bank, or Blackhawk County Veterans Affairs. Gregory Mike Harder has passed at the age of 71 of Fairbank, was killed in a tragic automobile accident in Bremer County on the 18th of July. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that donations be made in Mike's honor. Donations will be used to establish a memorial in his honor. Online condolences and a full obituary can be found at www.woodsfuneralhome.net. Johnson Patrick J.P., for short, Welch, passed on the 11th of July of this year. A memorial service will be held at a later date. All condolences and thoughts should be emailed to Nicola Roybal at comcast.net. Let me spell that for you. That's R-O-Y-B-A-L at comcast.net. Or emailed to Nicole Tribalhorn. Let me spell that for you. T-R-I-B-E-L-H-O-R-N at 1490 26th Street in Loveland, Colorado. And the zip code there is 80357. And now let's return to some other news. In Waterloo again, a Waterloo man is tied to Mexican drug gangs. At least two face charges of money laundering. At least two Waterloo men have been arrested on felony money laundering charges after allegedly assisting a Mexican drug trafficking operation. Richard Lewis Mohorn, age 46, and Mark Anthony Sales, age 31, were charged last week in connection with transferring the drug proceeds from Blackhawk County to the marijuana drug trafficking organization in Mexico. According to the criminal affidavit, detectives identified one of the main operators in Mexico who was supplying Blackhawk County individuals with large amounts of methamphetamine, heroin, and fentanyl. The operator was supplying another defendant with pounds of methamphetamine and thousands of pills containing fentanyl. Sales and Mohorn then were obtaining the meth and assisting in its distribution. On different days last year, the two men each transferred some $900 in meth and proceeds from Blackhawk County to Culiacan, Sinaloa, Mexico, where the main operator was or is believed to be living. The Tri-County Drug Enforcement Task Force is working with other agencies to investigate the activities of this organization. And moving on to other news now, trial for Iowa teen charged with killing teacher has been moved. In Fairfield, a trial for a 17-year-old charged with murder in the death of a Southeast Iowa high school Spanish teacher will be moved to Davenport, a judge ordered on Tuesday. The judge ordered that the trial for Jeremy Everett Goodell be moved about 80 miles from Fairfield to Davenport, a large city of 100,000 people on the Mississippi River. The move comes about a month after the trial for another teen charged with murder, Willard Miller, was moved about 200 miles west to Council Bluffs. The teens are accused of first-degree murder in the beating of a 66-year-old Noma Graber, who taught Spanish at Fairfield High School. Her body was found in a park November 3rd, hidden under a tarp, wheelbarrow, and railroad ties. She had been beaten to death with a baseball bat. And in other news, Hinson Miller Meeks offer OTC birth control measure. After passing a bill to protect same-sex and interracial marriages amid concerns the U.S. Supreme Court overturning a federal right to abortion access could jeopardize other rights criticized by conservatives, the U.S. House is poised to vote to establish a right to contraceptions nationwide. House Democrats say that the legislation would defend decades-long precedents and ensure access to contraceptives in the face of the Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. Iowa Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson intends to vote against the bill. Hinson instead introduced a separate bill with Iowa Republican U.S. Representative Marinette Miller Meeks that would ensure women over the age of 18 can access birth control pills over the counter. The bill requires the Food and Drug Administration to give priority review to already approved safe oral contraceptives for routine use so that they can be available over the counter for adult women. Birth control pills are available over the counter in most of the world, but are available in the U.S. only with a prescription. In contrast, emergency contraceptives, including Plan B, are already available over the counter. Drug maker HRA Pharma has asked that the Food and Drug Administration to approve an over-the-counter birth control pill called Opal. The agency's review progress is estimated to take about 10 months. Millions of American women safely use oral contraceptives and enabling women to access birth control pills at their local pharmacy is common sense policy, Hinson said in a statement. This is particularly important for women in rural areas who may have to drive over an hour to see their doctor. We should come together to support and empower women by expanding birth control access, improving maternal health care options, and ensuring women have the resources to choose life. I will continue working in a bipartisan manner to advocate for Iowa women and support families in Congress. The bill would also allow patients greater flexibility to use health savings and flexible spending accounts to pay for contraception, and waives stockpiling limitations on the purchase of over-the-counter items when using such accounts for birth control. As a state senator, Miller Meeks introduced and passed a bill in the Iowa Senate allowing women over 18 to buy oral contraceptives over-the-counter in Iowa. The bill, which was backed by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and Planned Parenthood, failed to win support in the Iowa House and died in the 2019 legislative session. Studies from the Guttmacher Institute and other medical researchers have shown access to contraception reduces abortion rates. This important bill will ensure that the FDA acts quickly to approve oral contraceptives for over-the-counter use, Miller Meeks said in a statement. As a woman and a doctor, I recognize the need for increased access to contraceptives and believe that this bill is an important step to promote women's health. Reynolds' war chest dwarfs opponents in governor's race. In Des Moines, the money in Iowa's campaign for governor continues to flow in Republican incumbent Kim Reynolds' favor. Reynolds more than doubled the fundraising by Democratic challenger Deidre DeGeer over the most recent state reporting period, state campaign funding documents are showing. Candidates for office in Iowa were required to file campaign fundraising documents on Tuesday. Reynolds' campaign reported raising just more than $633,000 from May 28th to July 14th, according to the state documents. DeGeer's campaign reported raising just shy of $256,000 over the same reporting period, according to the state documents. That continues the overall trend of Iowa's campaign for governor. Since last year, Reynolds' campaign has raised more than $5.8 million, while DeGeer, who formerly entered the race in mid-August, has raised $1.4 million. Reynolds finished the reporting period with more than $5.2 million in her campaign account, while DeGeer was sitting on just more than $503,000. A recent Mediacom Des Moines Register Iowa poll showed that Reynolds with a 17-point lead over DeGeer. Ernst joined GOP trip to the border. Iowa senator calls for stricter immigration policies after visit. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican of Iowa, called for a return to Trump-era border policies in a press conference with other Republican senators on Wednesday. Ernst was among Republicans senators led by Senators John Cornyn and Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, on its visit to the U.S. southern border last week, where the senators joined customs and border protection agents and law enforcement on various duties. The senators slammed Joe Biden's administration for changes made to border enforcement, including Biden's lifting of former President Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, which forced U.S. asylum seekers to stay in Mexico while their cases were resolved in U.S. immigration courts. The U.S. Supreme Court greenlit Biden's decision to lift the policy in a late June decision after it was blocked by a federal judge. She criticized President Joe Biden's implementation of alternatives to detention policies, which allow migrants to be released from detention while they await immigration court proceedings. This administration continues to encourage these dangerous journeys with their catch and release open door border policy, she went on to say. Ernst and U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, called for scrutinization of alternatives to detention policies this week. The American Civil Liberties Union contends that the policy is more humane and cost-effective compared to detention. Encounters with migrants at the southwest border reached a record high in May, with more than 240,000 encounters, according to the Department of Homeland Security, and they fell slightly in June. Encounters have been higher this fiscal year than the previous 3 years, according to the department's data. And now let's take a look at some entertainment. What to watch on Thursday, which is the 21st of July. American Horror Stories, this weekly anthology series spinoff of American Horror Story, returns for installment 2, consisting of 8 episodes with a different horror story available each Thursday beginning today with Dollhouse. And in others, movies, The Last Movie Stars on HBO Max, which is a new series here. Ethan Hawke directs this revealing 6-part documentary that celebrates the persona's talent and love story of actors Joan Woodward and Paul Newman. Central to The Last Movie Star is a long-abandoned project that Newman commissioned from friend and screenwriter Stuart Stern. At Newman's request, Stern interviewed close friends, family, and artistic collaborators for a planned memoir. Newman was also interviewed by Stern. They discussed his youth, his first marriage with Jackie Witt, his romance and life with Woodward, his personal demons, and the gut-wrenching loss of his son, Scott. In addition to archival interviews with Woodward and Newman, Hawke also enlisted numerous actors, including Karen Allen, George Clooney, Laura Linney, Sam Rockwell, and others to voice segments of the original transcribed interviews for the last movie stars. Hawk also interviewed some of Newman's daughters for insights into their parents, along with Sally Field and Martin Scorsese, who explore what made Woodward's and Newman's singular careers and relationship so inspiring. All six parts are available today. And let's take a look at some other things here. Catch a Classic, Deep Sea Cinema, Sea Monsters, Sharks, and Creatures from Below. Part 2 on TCM beginning at 7 p.m. Turner Classic Movies Deep Dive into Movies, featuring creepy sea creatures, continues tonight with films that include memorable scenes, if not entire plot lines devoted to tentacled terror from giant octopuses. The evening begins with Below the Sea, a 1933 action film about an underwater expedition starring Ralph Bellamy and Fay Wray. After that, It Came from Beneath the Sea, 1955 release, led by Kenneth Toby and Faith Domergue, about a giant octopus rampaging along the Pacific coast of America after being awakened by a nuclear testing. The film features terrific stop-motion special effects by the legendary Ray Harryhausen, particularly near the end when the beast attacks the Golden Gate Bridge and other parts of the San Francisco area. Up next is Tentacles, released in 1977, a delightfully cheesy Italian-made film about a seaside resort terrorized by a giant octopus. The film seems like it was quickly made to cash in on the killer sea creature horror trend that came in the wake of Jaws. Yet the cast somehow manages to include some very famous actors: John Huston, Shelley Winters, and Henry Fonda. The lineup winds down through the late night and early tomorrow morning with Warlords of Atlantis, a 1978 British adventure film led by Doug McClure, Beneath the 12-Mile Reef, a 1953 release, an adventure film following sponge fishermen off the coast of Florida, starring Robert Wagner, Isle of Fury, 1936, with Humphrey Bogart in one of the first leading roles as a fugitive gangster hiding from American justice in the Pacific, in the South Pacific, and Shh, the Octopus, a release of 1937, a comedy mystery starring Hugh Hubert and Alan Jenkins. Okay, let's turn now to some news digest. Uvalde schools might fire chief. Uvalde, Texas. Uvalde's top school official has recommended that the firing of the school district police chief, who has been blamed for the botched law enforcement response to the elementary school shooting nearly 2 months ago that killed two leaders and 19 students. The South Texas City's school board announced on Wednesday that it will consider firing Chief Pete Ardondo at a special meeting on Saturday. Ardondo has been accused by state officials of making several critical mistakes during the May 24th mass shooting at Robb Elementary School. The announcement comes 2 days after a meeting where the school board members were lambasted for more than 3 hours by members of the public who accused them of failing to hold Ardondo to account for his actions, among other things. Texas men indicted in migrant deaths in San Antonio. Two men were indicted Wednesday in the case of a hot airless tractor trailer rig found with 53 dead or dying migrants in San Antonio, officials said. A federal grand jury in San Antonio indicted Homero Zamorano Jr., age 46, and Christer Morantz, age 28, both of Pasadena, Texas, on counts of transporting and conspiring to transport migrants illegally, resulting in death, and transporting and conspiring to transport migrants illegally, resulting in serious injury. Both remain in federal custody without bond. Morant's attorney, David Scherer, declined to comment on the indictments. A message to Zeramano's attorney was not immediately returned. Conviction on the death counts could result in life sentences, but the Attorney General's office could authorize prosecutors to seek the death penalty. In both cases, the serious bodily injury counts carry sentences of up to 20 years in prison. And now let's take a look at some news briefs. In Ukraine, the U.S. and allies committed more rocket systems, ammunition, and other military aid to Ukraine Wednesday, as American defense leaders said that they see the war to block Russian gains in the eastern Donbas region grinding on for some time. Guns. House Democrats pushed ahead Wednesday with legislation in committee that would ban certain semi-automatic weapons, though the 100-page bill has little chance of becoming law due to opposition in the Senate. Democrats hope that the bill moving through the Judiciary Committee will pass the House before the August break. Abortion. Leaders of Indiana's Republican-dominated Senate on Wednesday proposed banning abortion with limited exceptions, a political firestorm over a 10-year-old rape victim who came to the state to end her pregnancy. Now, in news briefs, Giuliani, a judge in New York, ordered Rudy Giuliani to appear next month before a special grand jury in Atlanta's that investigating whether former President Donald Trump and other illegally tried to interfere in the 2020 general election in Georgia. Giuliani's lawyer did not immediately return a call and email seeking comment on Wednesday. Guns. House Democrats pushed ahead Wednesday with legislation in committee that would ban certain semi-automatic weapons, though the 100-page bill has little chance of becoming law due to opposition in the Senate. Democrats hope that the bill moving through the Judiciary Committee will pass the House before the August break. Wildfires. Battered by heavy winds, firefighters in Greece struggled to contain new fires Wednesday around the capital of Athens, while other countries in southern Europe took stock of the damage caused during the latest severe heat wave and prepared for the return of scorching temperatures. Postal Service. The U.S. Postal Service's plan to increase the number of electric-powered vehicles it's buying to replace its fleet of aging delivery trucks, officials said on Wednesday. The Postal Service anticipates boosting electric vehicles from 20% to 50% in its initial purchase of 50,000 vehicles, with the first of them rolling onto delivery routes next year. And in other news, Biden announces climate actions. President's initiative center on domestic offshore wind industry in Somerset, Mass. President Biden on Wednesday announced modest new steps to combat climate change and promised more robust action to come. The president stopped short, though, of declaring a formal climate emergency, which Democrats and environmental groups have been seeking after an influential Democratic senator quashed hopes for sweeping legislation to address global warming. Biden hinted such a step could be coming. Let me be clear, Biden said, climate change is an emergency. And in the coming weeks, I'm going to use the power I have as president to turn these words into formal, official government actions through the appropriate proclamations, executive orders, and regulatory power that a president possesses. Biden delivered his pledge at a formal coal-fired power plant in Massachusetts. The former Brayton Point power plant in Somerset, Mass. Is shifting to offshore wind power manufacturing, and Biden chose it as the embodiment of the transition to clean energy that he's seeking, but has struggled to realize in the first 18 months of his presidency. Executive actions announced Wednesday will bolster the domestic offshore wind industry in the Gulf of Mexico and Southeast, as well as expand efforts to help communities cope with soaring temperatures. And that does it for the reading of the Courier for Thursday, July 21st, 2022. I am your reader, Peter Welch, and you have been listening to Iris which is the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.
I'm getting older. Do I need to worry about falling?
Yes, you do. Every year, 1 in 4 people 65 and older will experience a fall, and many result in serious injury. The majority of falls happen at home, so take a look around. Replace bulbs and add lighting to help you see obstacles. Remove things that can make you trip. Fix uneven steps and floors, and install handrails in bathrooms and on stairs. Consider balance or strength training exercises, which can help with agility. Get your eyes and hearing checked regularly. Changes in your hearing can affect your balance. To learn more, please talk to your doctor about steps you can take to help prevent a fall. You can also visit aarpfoundation.org or medicaremadeclear.com/falls. This message was brought to you by United Healthcare and AARP Foundation.